The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and with me, of course, is Jeremy Goldcorn, the last crony of Zhou Yongkang, still moving freely about Beijing. Say hello, Jeremy.
Hello, Kaiser. And I have to say, once again, just like last week, Beijing arranged a beautiful day for us to record the podcast.
Well, this has
6 days of smog.
Wow. Right, but this is because of the Party Congress.
No, it's to counteract Ambassador Locke.
One of the two.
Yeah.
Man. Banana peel. Also with me is David Moser, who I think Grand Mason of the Ancient Accepted Scottish Rite Lodge over here in Sanlitor. Also Academic Director of the CET program in Beijing. Welcome, Brother Mason Moser.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes.
it may be that you're listening to our podcast today on China File, the excellent website from the good folks at the Asia Society. Susie Jakes and Jonathan Landreth are running a veritable one-stop shop for contemporary China watchers, where the writings of many luminaries from all sorts of different branches of China studies, disciplines, and academia, and journalism can all be found in one place. China File is the brainchild of Orville Schell, who is Arthur Ross Director of the Center of U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York. He is former professor and dean at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, Go Bears, and the author of no less than 15 books on China. His latest, which was co-authored with South Korea-based historian John DeLurie, is one of the most widely acclaimed books on China of recent years. It takes its place alongside works like The Gate of Heavenly Peace by Jonathan Spence and Joseph Levinson's Liang Qichao and the Mind of Modern China as a book that looks at the way that intellectuals and leaders, in this case from the late Qing all the way through Xi Jinping, have responded to the challenges of their day. Helps us to much better understand the present and maybe even anticipate the future. So today, we are delighted to welcome Orville Schell to Cynica. Orville, great to have you here at long last.
Great pleasure to be here with you three.
And so I guess today what we really want to do is I'm sorry I don't have a funny intro for you.
Well, praise the Lord.
Yeah. Today, we're going to talk about intellectual history in China and its modern fate, to make a reference to Levinson that hopefully some people will pick up on. So I want to get you to talk a little bit about China File and the work that the Asia Society's done. You know, obviously the conflict here, we are on China File, and I contribute to China. I think we all contribute to China File. So to tell us a little bit about how it's been doing and where it's going, what we can expect to see.
Well, it's great that you all contribute, and that was sort of precisely our hope, that we could create a site that would be something of a watering hole for everybody, and born of the recognition that, you know, there were a lot of interesting sites on China, but they tended to rise and fall. And they are often labors of love. Jeremy, you will certainly know whereof we speak.
I do. Guilty as charged.
Very hard to maintain. So we thought if we could do one that would be a place where other sites could sort of rally and create a sort of a watering hole, all-purpose place for people who are interested in China, it would, and attach it to some institution that had some hope of survival, it would be a noble thing to do. And so we've done that, and now really pleased we're just effecting a whole new partnership with Foreign Policy. So we'll be teaming up with them, sort of doing much China coverage with them and for them.
That's great. That's really great to hear. So I want to jump right into this. My own experience in China studies, I came to the formal study of China in like I said, the fall of 89, and the role of intellectuals in China's politics, as well as the importance of understanding intellectual history and the relationship between state and intellectuals, was stunningly obvious at the time. This was 89, after all. I thought it was really the key to understanding China. But part of the reason that I fled academia was my sense that intellectual history had it was sort of a career dead end for me. It was falling very much out of favor. So what's the state of modern Chinese intellectual history in the academy today? Is there a dearth of good writing on intellectual history? And if so, why?
Well, I think, you know, you fled once, I fled several times and returned. And I think, you know, one of the tragedies of sort of China studies is that in many ways it's been captured by the social sciences and all sorts of sort of behavioral theorists. And I do lament the passing of intellectual history because I think it's both a mirror of what happens and also the intellectuals who form it, or maybe they're politicians, maybe they're business people as well, they also tended to have an influence on history. So you can kind of, there was input and output. And I think it's a tremendously effective way actually to draw people into history, because you do it through people who existed as human beings and who had lives as well as thoughts. So that was, anyway, the conceit of our book, Wealth and Power, to try to look at modern Chinese history through a whole series of sort of emblematic doers, thinkers, activists to try to make sense out of how did we get to now? After 150 years of serial dead ends, cancellations, and, you know, seemingly periods of history that seemed to go nowhere. So how did it add up? And that was the question we posed to ourselves.
Another problem maybe is that it seems like the intellectuals, and not just the academia intellectuals, but the writers and the artists have at all times in the 20th century and especially in the late 20th century been at odds with or struggling for political causes against the government or for the government. And I think a general problem with Chinese studies overall is I think that intellectual history, the arts, literature seems to get subsumed under political science. Like film is another example that's always treated as political rather than artistic. It's never judged on its own merits. Look at Lu Xun, look at Ba Jian, look at almost any writer. And I think that intellectual history has suffered also, which is why it's so nice to see this book that goes into such depth. It's the first book I've seen in a long time that actually outlines the intellectual history and the history of those thinkers through the 20th century until now in a coherent form. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a tragedy of China's upheavals in the 20th century, that everything gets subsumed under political upheaval.
But can I ask a question? The framing device, the title of the book is Wealth and Power. And if I just saw the title Wealth and Power without knowing anything about it, I wouldn't think that it was a book of intellectual history. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's interesting, Jeremy. I mean, it was quite a surprise, I think, to us, John DeLurie and I, to find this sort of mantra, you know, Fu Chang, sort of recur again and again and again and again. And I think we came to this, I mean, listen, I've spent my whole life trying to wallow around in Chinese history. And I had to admit to myself, I couldn't really make sense out of it. Hmm. You know, what, if you look at it in a kind of a teleological sense, you know, what was the motion? What was the goal towards which Chinese history was sort of directing itself? We in the West very often think, not to be too esoteric about it, but in Hegelian terms of history moving towards, I think we tend to imagine greater openness, greater democracy, enlightenment values. And you remember Francis Fukuyama, the end of history. Well, we had kind of gotten there. And it turned out, well, history did start up again. And so I think for us to try to sense what was the main current flowing through Chinese history, it was, in fact, we concluded, this desire to see China great again, to become a country of consequence. And wealth and power really described it, and it was something that almost everybody in some form or other, whether nationalist, communist, dynastic, anarchist, Christian, they all understood that aspect. And I think that was a tremendously important animating impulse that got us to the present.
That's right. I was reviewing something that I had written back in 2001, in April of 2001. It was a column I'd written for Time magazine at the time. I was alternating weeks with Matthew Forney doing a column called Made in China. And April, of course, of 2001 was the month where the EP3 spy plane incident happened, bringing back immediately memories of what had happened spring 2 years prior to that, which is of course, the Belgrade incident. And one of the things that I kept running into, what people were always asking me about, was, you know, how can these people, these Chinese friends of mine who appear to be so liberal, who are cosmopolitans, who embrace universal values, how can they, where does this strain of virulent nationalism well up from? And in explaining that in this particular column, I went directly to Fuqiang, to the concept of wealth and power, and explained that liberalism and nationalism in China, especially in the late 19th century and the early 20th, they developed in lockstep, that there were not thinkers. I mean, whoever you looked at, whether it was Chen Duxiu or Liang Qichao or anyone, their embrace of what we call liberalism was as a means toward decidedly nationalist ends and that any time you would see the means and the end come to conflict, the end would naturally prevail. It's what they're after, and so that's why when I picked up your book and I saw that it was in that. I mean, the, it had sort of found that same idea. It resonated so much with me. For now, when we look at the last 170 years or so of Chinese history, from the Opium War, I think one of the recurrent things that we talk about is sort of contested visions of modernity. So one of the questions I have for you, it seems to me that Western historiography, and not just Western, but I'm also thinking about, Chinese historiography, sort of the meta-narrative of history. It is teleological, or it does. We don't seem to be able to escape that. I want to talk about all the different writers or the different thinkers that you include in this. But I also want to say, you're somebody who has raised this idea of, the problematic nature of our teleological historiography, how we tend to not be able to escape this idea that. But I can't help thinking that when I come to the later chapters of your book, you kind of fall into it. I mean, the choice of Liu Xiaobo, for example. I mean, I can see everyone else has already had their impact. I mean, you cannot argue that. Everyone all the way up to, Zhu Yongji has had in their thinking a clear impact on the way that China has been shaped. But when you get to Liu Xiaobo, it's almost more wishful. Or how would you answer that criticism?
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I mean, I think I look at it this way, that up until roughly now, I would say the primary sort of impulse, but there were exceptions, that animating most people was this real desire that you have properly, I think, identified, fired by nationalism, to see the nation become great again. Mm-hmm. Now, that's wealth and power. Now, I think you could also say that we're arriving at a point where China has acquired a good quotient of wealth and power. So once it's acquired those goals, then, in a certain sense, history may start up again in some slightly different way that then may be, and this is why we included Liu Xiaobo, then it may be that we head off in a more Hegelian direction. So you may say I'm having my cake and eat it too, but this is to say the last 70 years, I think, were headed in the direction of strong nation, which required wealth, power, and nationalism. Once that is accomplished, it's not quite yet, and there's still a great deal of insecurity and a great deal of victim culture aloft in the land, then maybe these other impulses for a more open, just, fair, democratic society. Mm-hmm. Maybe history will kind of get back on the old Hegelian teleology again. I don't know. But we certainly wanted to open that door at the end.
Okay. That's a fair and reasoned answer.
Can I just mention something that has been a thread through other podcasts we've done, and which Orwell's book sheds light on, which is the relationship of the Chinese intellectuals toward democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think what's one of the interesting frameworks of this book that I got was of democracy as being something that was, you know, in the air and something that is being talked about even now in the halls of Zhongnanhai and stuff like that. But what's interesting is that they tend to treat democracy not as an abstract ideal or as a principle, but as a tool of mm-hmm. governance to be used to achieve wealth and power.
Right,
it's such a powerful nature, yeah. That was such an eye-opening awareness for me, because we had talked in this podcast even about, you know, the Chinese attitude towards democracy. And you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the striking thing as you go through all this history and you look at the various schools of thought that enter, it's like trying on suits of clothes.
Yeah, right.
They put them on, they look in the mirror, this is not quite right. Take them off, try something else. It's very utilitarian. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think there is an aspect of that that's striking. And, you know, for a while it seemed like democracy was the tool which would bring wealth and power. You know, the Industrial Revolution.
The West had it. Right?
The West had it. So, okay. So how did they get it? Well, maybe it was democracy. Mm-hmm. So there was a burst of enthusiasm for that. Then Leninism came along. Gee, this looks pretty good. Strong state, one party, ideology, discipline. Then that kind of crashed and burned. And then you have Deng Xiaoping, and he says, well, how about a little capitalism? Let's let's have a go at that. And now I think we're heading off into some new territory with Xi Jinping. It isn't quite clear what the model is, but it's still very utilitarian.
Could I just add one other example? Is I can't imagine a culture that for many thousands of years, its cornerstone was Confucianism, which then under Mao was totally repudiated and dead and buried. And then they brought it back again. That's just
trying.
Astounding. Yeah.
Well, they're trying, right?
They're trying, yeah.
To the chagrin of some.
Poor Confucius.
Yeah. He's been, you know, exhumed many times, reburied. I guess I want to go back and look at the structure of the book here and ask you maybe what were the criteria for inclusion of the particular intellectuals that you focused on? Everyone from, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, some of these people are no-brainers, I mean, to have included.
Could we just run through the chapters, perhaps?
Sure, sure. I mean, why don't we do that? It starts,
the first one is Wei Yuan. And should we talk
sure.
a little bit about
a quick bio on Wei Yuan, then?
Well, here was a guy at the very sort of, you know, even before the Opium War, was sensing some rot in the escutcheon of China. And slowly sensing after the Opium War, something wasn't right. These guys who had arrived from the West had some strength. And yet he didn't speak any foreign language. He'd never been abroad. So these guys are sort of trying to, the blind man feeling the elephant. They're trying to figure out, I mean, okay, who are these people? What's out there? And where do they get their energy? So he was a very kind of interesting sort of point of departure when the West first arrives and China has to kind of begin to come to terms with it with very limited ability to know about the West.
As you said, though, when you first started to introduce him, he was aware of this even before encountering the West. So that's what I think the important thing is. We do want to sort of shake ourselves out of that. I mean, it might be, you know, a cursory read of your book might think that this is still all about response, which is a decidedly unpopular way to approach modern Chinese history now. I mean, now everyone will tell you that this was sort of, you know, the last straw rather than the response to the West wasn't the only defining, I mean, it wasn't what defines modern history, right? So, including a character like this, who is part of a whole late Qing movement in neo-Confucian thought that has decidedly modern strains in it already. You know, an empiricist kind of an approach. I thought that was an important reason to include him.
Yeah, there is this notion, isn't there, in China of a dynasty in decline and seeking a zhongxing, you know, a rejuvenation, which is interesting
revival,
because we now have Xi Jinping talking about a different kind of rejuvenation, fuxing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think Wei Yan was sort of part of that recognition that dynastic cycles, you could kind of protract them a little. If you could identify the sort of indigenous problems in the dynasty and reform it. And then, of course, the West came and sort of made it doubly, it was double jeopardy.
And so after William, we have like Feng Guifeng, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, Feng Guifeng, who another kind of no-brainer, and as well as...
it's an interesting term, word to refer to.
He belongs in this...
He definitely belongs in this intellectual history.
Right. Yeah. I guess what I'm interested in, rather than going through, is like who doesn't get included.
Well, we had to throw a bunch of people out of the helicopter because it was just not going to take off.
And some people get sort of, you know, crammed. Like in the Chen Duxiu chapter, you end up... there's quite a few pages given over to Lu Xun.
Yeah, because we did a whole chapter on Lu Xun, and I adore Lu Xun,
yeah,
and I wrote
doesn't?
The chapter. But, you know, he doesn't quite fit into the wealth and power narrative because he's much more interested in sort of internal things.
Right.
He's more like Kafka. You know, he's interested in the inside of his own brain and China's brain. So
he's also more like Boyang in the 80s,
which is
he's more of a social critic. He's more like a doctor diagnosing the illness.
Interestingly, yeah, exactly. He was a doctor.
Yeah, he was a doctor. That's true. Yeah.
Yes, he was. He and I think he was interested in sort of almost the psychological side of things,
right.
Not the exterior, recrudescence of power, majesty, you know, awe, all of these things which China is still fixated on.
Absolutely. And then Hu Shi also sort of gets slightly short shrift.
Yeah. He was another one, and I'll tell you why he got short shrift. I love Hu Shi, partially because he's easy to read.
Yeah.
He's a joy to read in Chinese. But he really was part of what I think was a bit of an epiphenomenon, namely these very westernized people who do deeply believe in openness, democracy, and liberalism. But in that sense, he wasn't really, I think, in the main flow of 20th century Chinese history.
Mm.
A powerful person.
You. I would have to agree with you there.
Who's in reserve for the future, perhaps, but he wasn't answering the questions, I think, that most people were suffering from.
Where if you sort of trace the narrative arc of Chen Duxiu, he's very much of the moment. He kind of expresses the
zeitgeist. He's for science and democracy, but he's also a big-time nationalist.
Mm-hmm. Right. Big-time nationalist, and it's really his embrace of Marxism-Leninism that matters the most. I love to turn over that moment in my head. You know, what was it that was so appealing about Marxism-Leninism to the Chinese of that moment? These were, you know, let's remember, in the May 4th period, with the Russian Revolution still only 2 years old, but what was it that the Bolsheviks had? It was, I still kind of tend to frame things in a kind of Levinsonian way. You know, it has to satisfy meum and verum. It has to be, you know, mine and true. And what Leninism seems to me to do is it is at once Western, and therefore, you know, it has that sort of and it casts itself in a sort of scientific
pseudoscience, right?
But it has that patina of science to it that they could grab onto, and yet it is a critique of Western society, and it aligns itself, I mean, specifically Leninism, against imperialism, which at that moment was enemy number one. It explains the China's poverty. It explains China's weakness. It explains the predatory nature of capitalism. I think it had an almost irresistible appeal. It must have had an irresistible appeal at that moment.
Yeah, I think it does. It makes China explicable in terms of its suffering and its the way in which it was preyed upon through Lenin's theories on imperialism, but it also offered up one other incomparable thing, which every Chinese in the 20th century, with the exception of people like Hu Shi, really appreciated. That was the model of a strong state, a strong leadership, an ideology, a disciplined party structure. Sun Yat-sen bought into it, Chiang Kai-shek bought into it, Mao, Chen Doshu, they all bought into it, except for Lu Xun. And so this was the remedy for, you know, the Sun Yat-sen's famous dictum that China was Yipan Sansha, dish of, or sheet of loose sand. And he very graphically said that what that dish of sand needed was some binding agent. And right. Leninism was the binding agent.
And so this, in the Sun Yafi Manifesto of 23, with the reorganized KMT, they explicitly embrace a Leninist party structure. And what's interesting is that I think a lot of people don't understand that the Kuomintang itself was, and was all the way up through the time of martial law, still explicitly Leninist in its organizational structure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's quite a revelation to a lot of people. And also, it's interesting to remember, we write about this a bit, that Chiang Kai-shek had more than a minor flirtation with fascism.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, that is another, that certainly has, it would have a lot of appeal. If you look at Mussolini, I mean, you have once glorious nation, you have that kind of reactive nationalism having been, you know, trodden upon, you know, these appeals to sort of the militarization of society. Zhang is a Wanpo, you know, Huangpu Academy graduate. Tell us a little bit about Zhang and his fascist flirtations.
Well, I think he too looked at the sort of piteous state that China was in. You know, this is he launched the Northern Expedition and more or less unified it, making deals and conquering a few warlords. But still, it was pretty ragtag bunch of disaggregated pieces. And I think he felt that the sort of symbols that fascism offered of a strong, kind of exciting leader with lots of medals and mining certain sort of traditional, you know, Hitler did this very nicely, all the whole thing about sort of Teutonic myth, and Mussolini did too, that he was quite, found that quite appealing as a way to bind up China into a new whole with a big, strong leader. And, you know, all these guys wore these absurd uniforms just bedecked with medals and Prussian hats with feathers sticking out of them. This was all an effort to make a leader significant enough, I think, to sort of draw the loyalty of the Chinese people back into something that was sort of reconstituted as a nation.
Don't you think there's some little echo of dynastic yearning here also? I mean, even Yuan Shikai, you know, dressed up like an emperor, and the fascism that this on the surface level has the accoutrements of dynasty. You know, it has the epic scope, large, you know, palaces and everything, and the strong leader, and the people are a pan of loose sand. I mean, it resonates almost subconsciously, I would think.
Well, one would, I mean, I think that the analogy would have been to a Bonaparte.
Yeah.
My sense would have
yes,
been.
I mean, he certainly made France grand. And we remember that when Chiang Kai-shek came to power, he had this great vision of building a new capital, and did, in Nanjing. And, you know, grand boulevards copied from Napoleon in France and Washington. And he had the whole damn thing laid out in a kind of an incredibly grand way. So there was this a sense, and I think we still see it in China today, that sort of this love of grandeur, because it sort of papers over the insecurity of a disaggregated nation and a kind of a battered people. So you build a Tiananmen Square, you build a new Nanjing, you build a Sun Yat-sen mausoleum, and it makes it look like things are a lot more together than actually they may be. You know, you asked Kaiser about the people who how did we choose? Well, so we had to get rid of Lu Xun. We would have done Li Hongzhang, you know, but it just wasn't room. We tried our hardest to figure out a way to do, you know, Hu Jintao, But he was like eating styrofoam.
That's right. I mean, that whole decade gets just passed over very quickly.
It was very hard to. So we kind of had to throw him out.
Right.
And, who's Hu Jintao? I don't remember.
You remember that guy? Nobody remembers.
Well, this is a problem. You know, even Jiang Zemin, you know, actually looking back on Jiang Zemin now, I have to say, whereas one, at one point he did appear to be, I think, somewhat clownish. Now I look back on him with a certain fondness.
Oh, absolutely.
He was quite open. Mm. He was trying to be a mensch. He was trying to sort of run with the big guys.
You have that whole dialogue between him and Clinton.
It was fabulous. I was sitting right there during it in the front row watching Jiang Zemin with, you know, with Bubba, the master of the master of sort of repartee, and trying to sort of imitate him. And it was quite touching. He did quite well. And looking back on it, I'd have to say there isn't a snowball's chance in hell that Hu Jintao or Xi Jinping would risk such a wager.
She might.
She has got this reputation for trying to be, you know, a man of the people, and he's eating at the local restaurant and everything. But Jiang Zemin was getting out his guitar and singing Elvis.
He had a bit of a sense of humor about himself, which he does not seem to have.
He really did. And he wanted to be like a normal person, a normal leader.
Yeah.
He didn't want to just be this sort of mysterious wizard behind the veil.
Support for this week's show comes from Brattle Street Educational Counseling. Stressed out about college applications, Brattle Street Educational Counseling can help. They provide guidance throughout the whole process and offer workshops for students looking to work in small groups at a rigorous pace. The workshops include hours of one-on-one attention, from college essays to standardized test prep to interviewing and applications. Brattle Street offers support for any student. Brattle Street, BRATTLE Street.com, helping you get where you want to go.
So I have a little bit of a beef of late. I'm somebody who believes very much that the interaction between the intellectual and the state is sort of the driving piston of Chinese politics. That it's, you know, that relationship between the pen and the sword. If we assume that to be that may sound very elitist to a lot of people there, but I really do believe it to be the case. And I also believe that, as a result, it's very important to understand intellectuals in China today. My beef is this, that I have a sense that people who are writing the first draft of intellectual history are, ignoring entirely, a whole very, very important, I mean, I hate to use the word, but sort of silent majority of intellectuals today. They're instead conflating the idea of dissident and the idea of intellectual, you can't be an intellectual if you aren't in active opposition. And I admit that I was a little, as you know, flipped the pages of the book and realized that, you know, say Wang Hui was not included, or that there weren't more establishment intellectuals. There wasn't anybody sort of in there who argues the intellectual position for let's take the grand compromise. Let's because that is a sensible position for somebody who seeks wealth and power. The stand in there would be Zhu Rongji.
Yeah.
But do you feel that's kind of unfair? Would you agree, first of all, that there's this conflation of activist, dissident, and intellectual in the minds of a lot of, say, journalists today?
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think, you know, the truth is the intellectuals who become sort of spokesmen or make the case for the status quo and for the powers that be, they're finally not very interesting because they don't exist really in a state of tension with anything, unless they're in a debate. So they too are hard to write about.
Right.
So I think
you didn't want to put Eric Exley in
there. No, actually, I find him pretty interesting.
I do too.
And making as good a case as you can make, which isn't a bad case at all. I mean, I have to say, I am a big-hearted Democrat with a small D, but I look at what's going on in the Ukraine and Egypt and Libya, and I got to say, a lot of these springtimes you know, they skipped summer and fall and hit right into winter. Right.
Mm-hmm. But Kaz, I don't think you can really. I mean, that's you're talking about something you feel generally, but in terms of this book, Orville and John's book, I mean, post-revolutionary China, we have Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, Zhu Rongji.
Right, but these are our political leaders. These aren't these aren't the deep thinkers, right?
Well, so two other people that finally had to be reduced to a few pages. One was Wei Jingsheng, mm-hmm. Obviously.
Not an intellectual, arguably. I mean, yeah.
No, but he fits your billing of a anti-state intellectual, for sure.
And someone who is bringing up democracy again, not as a tool for wealth and power.
That's right.
But in principle.
Right? Exactly. And Fang Lijie, the same thing. Yeah. He was another one who believed in democracy, not because he thought it would make China wealthy and powerful, but just because he was a kind of an idealist. And he actually believed that human beings deserve to be free.
Right.
And that's certainly not in the tradition of utilitarianism.
I got to know him at Arizona because his building was actually, his atmospheric sciences building was right next to the Franklin building where the East Asia Studies Department was housed. So I saw him a lot and we chatted. I mean, I don't know that he was China's Sakharov, but...
But he was as close as he got to somebody who was trying to think about... You know, he'd go to Europe and he'd go to Florence and he would look around and, you know, he was sort of as broad-minded as a scientist kind of got in China.
Mm, in China at the time. One thing that I wish I could have seen in there would have been one of the many thinkers from the 1980s who were looking very deeply at neo-authoritarianism, which... turns out to, I mean, so technocratic neo-authoritarianism was sort of, that was the buzzword of the day in the 80s. So you had like Wang Ruoshui, Wang Wurong, people mm-hmm. like that who might have been candidates for inclusion. Did we look at those types?
That's an interesting thought. You know, those I knew both of those guys and I knew something about them, of course, but... I mean, it would have been interesting to include one of them, I think. They both had rather bitter ends. Despite their authoritarianism. And that was a school of thought that in the late 80s had a brief flourishing, and then its major spokesman, Zhao Ziyang, ended up getting cashiered himself.
And that's right.
Put away in house arrest, I might add, on none other than Fu Chang Hutong.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, there's a poignant moment in there. It's because people forget that it was actually Zhao who delivers the excommunication, essentially, of Fang Lijie.
That's right.
Which I thought was a very poignant moment in the later paragraphs or one of the later chapters.
Before you get off of intellectuals, can I just ask Orville a question about intellectuals?
Sure, of course.
You know, I don't know as many and never knew as many as you did, but when I was at Beida in the 80s, I would meet not famous ones, but intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And it always struck me that there was a lack of the kind of Chomsky type of intellectual that had a feeling, a resonance for the mm-hmm. for the common people and for social justice. Whenever you talk to them, they would have a kind of contempt for the people, especially when you would talk about democracy. They would point out there and say, look, you expect those people out there to be able to understand democracy. They're you know, soldier ideal, you know, they're peasants. And does that strike a bell with you? I mean,
well, that's very Chinese, isn't it? I mean, it's the traditional role of an intellectual was to be, you know, not
sort of elite. They're very elitist.
They were very elitist. Deeply. I mean, and this is why Mao Zedong hated them. You know,
he
got snubbed by them when he was working in the Beida Library, and he never got over it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he thought intellectuals were just completely useless.
So, just partially selfishly, next week I'm going to be interviewing at the Bookworm Literary Festival Jonathan Fenby, who's just written a book.
Oh, great. Yeah.
A book called Will China Dominate the 21st Century? You've just completed this book. You know, you've obviously it's set you in motion as say you sort of now see the broad outlines of history across the last 170 odd years. Will China dominate the 21st century?
You know, Kaiser, I've got to tell you, I think ever since 1989, when I think, I don't know if you guys were there.
I was here.
Yeah. I was here.
Me. I mean, you know, I don't think it is one of us who thought after that they'd ever get the genie back in the bottle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But they did. And I think many of us during the ensuing 20, 25 years would think over and over again, this shouldn't work. But somehow it did. I mean, work, whatever that means. It went on. And it did pretty damn well, mm-hmm. in actuality. So when you ask, will China dominate the world? I think you have to ask yourself, well, first of all, we're not very good at predictions. So probably better not to wager
I'm
an answer. But second of all, whatever is going on, a lot of it is very counterintuitive.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it makes it very hard to judge. I continue to think that there's so many contradictions and fracture lines and problems inherent in this whole proposition that it shouldn't work. And mm-hmm. that makes me think, well, maybe they're coming up against an inflection point. But then I'd thought that numerous times before.
Who hasn't? Yeah,
so what do we do with that? I'm not sure I can answer.
Muddling through doesn't mean dominating the century, of course, but... Yeah. And you know, we have to ask the question, does China want to dominate?
I'd like to go back to Liu Xiaobo and raise a different question from Kaiser, because, to me, it actually makes a lot of sense to end the book with Liu Xiaobo, because, I almost feel that, it's not quite there yet, but China is rich and powerful now. It's not the richest and the most powerful, and it could all collapse tomorrow for a bunch of reasons we've discussed many times on the show. But compared to, you know, any time since 1842, it's rich and powerful. And my daily sort of both existential and just philosophical quarrel and query with China is, okay, you're rich and powerful now, so what are you going to do with that? And to me, Liu Xiaobo is a person who, whether you like his writings or not, but his treatment here and the treatment of his wife suggests to me that there's not really an answer to that. You know, what else aside from being rich and powerful? Is that it? Is that all Chinese culture is going to offer the globe? Was that any way part of your thinking in putting Liu Xiaobo into the end of the book? And
yeah.
What is his question for China and China's future?
So I think the question that he poses for China and for indeed all of us is sort of, what's the real goal? I mean, and for him, the real goal is not simply to be wealthy and powerful and to look good. He's much more of a humanist. Mm. And I think also lurking in the back of his critique is something that the leaders now sort of see but are quite surprised by, namely that getting wealthy and getting powerful doesn't, as everybody sort of thought for lo these 170 years, create ipso facto respect. And that is what is really wanted, is respect. That's why there's such an incredible fixation on soft power. Yeah. And I think Liu Xiaobo is sort of trying to feel his way towards an answer of respect. And basically what he is saying, if I read him correctly, is if you want to be respected, you first of all have to earn the respect of your own people. Mm. And I think this is where China is still incomplete. And so in a certain sense, his answer is, you know, justice does create a kind of a respect of your own people. And until that can be brought home, the most yearned for aspect of the whole 20th century sort of struggle, which is to be respected by the world, is still elusive. And it is very galling, I think, for these leaders to find it can't be had by control alone.
Hmm. So, I mean, it's not something that's directly addressed in your book, but China's fixation with humiliation at the hands of imperial powers, beginning with the Opium War, and, you know, certainly it's shaped the PRC's attitudes and its policies toward the end, toward its non-Han ethnic groups that are within the borders that it essentially inherited from the Qing Empire. Can you talk a little bit about how these attitudes are playing out now. China's ideas about historical oppression at the hands of imperialist aggressors, and its own thinking with its own obsession on separatism and that sort of thing. We're witnessing some real horrors, self-immolations in Tibet, of course, and then the terrorist attacks in Kunming that just happened a few days ago. How do these two things relate, or do they?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of ironic, isn't it, that a country which wove a fabric of anti-imperialist critique and a victimization by superior powers, stronger powers, should be elaborating a similar syndrome over some of its minorities, whether it's in Xinjiang or Tibet, most notably.
Of course, it makes sense also that it regards these as these sovereign, inviolable borders, and it that's why it's particularly prickly when it comes to the old enemy meddling again in our internal affairs by its definition. But yeah, the irony is certainly there.
That's very powerful too. I mean, anything where there's meddling just gets China's back up. But I do think that there is a terrible tendency that every country has to be mindful of, that, you know, if you've been oppressed, it's very easy to prove that you have turned the tide by putting the shoe on the other foot. And I think it in some very cryptic way that very few Chinese would care to acknowledge, it may give a certain satisfaction to have a few benighted minorities to whom you are bringing civilization, just as the missionaries once thought they were bringing civilization to the heathens of China. There's a lot of complicated things going on here
Right, absolutely. Let's look at some of the things that have happened in just a few days since the horrible attacks. The whole controversy over the T word, over the alleged failure of the U.S. media to call it terror without the sneer quotes, without the scare quotes, in the immediate aftermath. Now, of course, there are plenty of reasons that Western journalists will give. They'll say, well, look, our editorial policy is just avoid that word when you can. That's Reuters. Secondly, they'll have their own sort of definitions, and some of them will argue that there was so much opacity that you didn't have full information. You didn't have the capability to make a judgment, and you weren't going to, based on their past record, simply believe the Chinese authorities the moment they started using the T word. You're just going to repeat it. But at the same time, you know, we understand that it's a very freighted decision. Just the decision not to make it itself is very value laden, right? And one might expect that you should, be able to muster the empathy to realize that your decision not to use that word is going to hurt the feelings of the Chinese people, as it were. Where do you guys all stand on that particular issue?
Look, I grew up in a country where anyone fighting against apartheid was a terrorist, so I've never liked the word. I think I've always found it a word that is abused more than it's used usefully.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I hate the word, the global war on terror.
I think that the Chinese government putting out editorials, like today there was one in Xinhua, crowing about the fact that now the quote marks were gone from the Western reports, whereas maybe it would be better to obsess about other things connected with this attack. So for me, I sympathize with the idea that why should, yellow-skinned lives be worth less than white-skinned lives, essentially, and it's not terrorism when it happens to Chinese people just because the government is one way or another. I do sympathize with that. But on the other hand, I just think that, making such a huge fuss about that is, who cares?
Look, the anger of this didn't come from the state media. The anger over it came, from ordinary people on Weibo, right? That's where let's be clear on that.
I'm not sure about that. I think the state media reported it first, Kaiser.
No.
I'm not sure about that.
Immediately afterward, you started seeing these comparisons going around, and these were being made by ordinary netizens.
Terror is one of those words that draws the line. When you use it, then it suddenly draws a certain line. You remember the problems Obama got into supposedly because he didn't use the word terror in conjunction with the Benghazi attack. And then the right, you know, said, you know, didn't use it. So they were wanting him to draw the line. And I think that's the problem with the word, is that it draws a line artificially, even in the Benghazi case.
Right, but I mean, that's the problem. In common usage, it's become something that you know, when you apply the word, you are you're saying that this political
you're putting the white and black hats on the two sides, right?
Right, but it crosses a threshold into a certain level, a new level of heinousness, and it's kind of an important. I mean, it's very problematic. I completely agree, but that you're choosing to decide. Oh, now we're going to address the problematic nature of it now. That is problematic too.
I didn't think it's just no, but I think we should ask Orville what he thinks about this.
Okay. I was hoping
an equal participant in the
conversation. Would explain.
Stick you in the hot seat, no?
You know, one thing that does, I can't help notice about this brouhaha is how important it is to have the United States sympathize, you know, with China.
Absolutely.
And I think here the United States was a bit slow at the pitch. It could have said something early on. We're not sure what happened, but it's a horrendous loss of life. And we are, you know, tremendously regretful and sympathetic and share, you know, pain that Chinese must be feeling. And then later on, we can figure out who did it, you know, whether it's terrorism or not. But I think, you know, there still is this abiding, even though China puffs itself up and pretends like it doesn't care, it still really matters.
Oh, deeply.
Mm-hmm. What the West, you know, the West, not so much Japan, because they're sort of over the edge anyway, you know, thinks about China. And this kind of, I think, gets back to this notion of, do you even respect us enough to sympathize with us when we get killed?
That's true. I think one of the top headlines in the top box on Xinhua's website today was something along the lines of international community removes quote marks from terrorism, basically.
Well, I'm glad they did. I'm personally.
But you can be sorry without saying this is a pack of Muslim terrorists. I mean, anyway, it wasn't. But you know, I understand Washington had a huge snow and ice storm. It was the weekend, and when they finally did get around to saying something, I think they had to do it by phone. Because no reporters could get to the
press
conference.
Between ambassadors right now, and it's
yeah. Right.
Another issue for me with Kunming, there were a lot of people, and we could have expected this, of course, that in analysis in Anglophone media afterward, you saw a kind of perfunctory acknowledgement of the monstrosity of the event. Mm-hmm. But then now let's look at the real reason. That's fine, right? Let's look at the real reason. The perfunctory nature of it, which I thought sometimes was hollow, bothered me. But what bothered me worse was when we did get to analysis of root causes, the narrative was entirely around Chinese repression, as though everything that has happened in Xinjiang has occurred in isolation from the radicalization of much of the rest of the Islamic world. And there's like this almost deliberate effort to say, pretend, you know, I mean, it's there in the subtext when you deny the East Turkestan Islamic movement's existence. It's there in the subtext when you say, we're outside forces. No. And when you sneer at the Chinese outside forces explanation, and it's bizarre. I looked at so many of these analyses. Alongside that, it's necessary a couple of paragraphs talking about the problems of, and they are very real problems, of minority policies. Why wasn't there a paragraph that talked about the rise of Islamic nationalists everywhere else? Where, I mean, I'm going to invoke Levinson again. An idea is a choice among many ideas. And when suddenly you have as your possible responses a lot of new ideas, you know, Wahhabism or Al-Qaeda or Islamic movement of Uzbekistan or all these other alternatives and the responses that they've chosen, that changes things. That changes things, and it should be part of the conversation, no?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've seen a little bit of this in Syria, you know, when suddenly the Al-Qaeda start showing up on the side of the freedom fighters, and they make things, everything's suddenly gets quite confused. And I think in China here, we have a bit of the same thing. On the one hand, we actually may have some rather wild and crazy Islamic fundamentalists acting out, But at the same time, you do have an unpleasant situation of sort of Han domination in Xinjiang. It's very hard to sort these two things out.
Right.
You notice also the right-wing media even fell in the same line, because normally if there was a case like this in a country that's more neutral from our interest, there'll be this yelling on the right about Islamofascism, and look, here it's cropping up again. But because the right is not well disposed to the PRC government, then it fits into this narrative of repression. So they weren't squawking about it. They were muted about it as well.
Not that I would, you know, ordinarily take comfort in the rights.
But I do think this is also another case of you know, the Chinese government's, you know, extreme lack of communication skills and the planning around the communication of this. I mean, for example, this event, it happened within 24 hours. Xinjiang separatists were blamed. Then there were apparently police photographs of a T-shirt that had a Uyghur script on it that just said Uyghur with a black T-shirt. That's all it said.
That's all that was visible.
Well, on the front of it, that was all that was visible.
Well, it was in Arabic, actually.
Arabic script, but apparently it was Uyghur, and it said Uyghur. And that was given as the evidence that it was Islamic separatists. And then within, what is today, Tuesday, the actual headlines were Xinjiang, what was a terrorist case solved. That was an actual headline on Xinhua, which then created another quote mark situation, which I think you observed somewhere on the internet. I saw where some Western media outlet said, put the solved in quotation marks, quoting Xinhua. But it seems, I think, to the outside viewer, if you can solve a case like this in 2 days, it's solved. Now we know everything. You know, it's done. It doesn't lend credibility to your cause, and it makes the outside observer think, well, there's something a bit fishy here.
Sure, I understand. But you should also understand that so much of what was done entirely for a domestic audience. Solved was sort of to try to allay further fear, panic, and, you know.
Fine, but then the international audience has no reason to take it seriously if it's propaganda. Okay. I mean, that's what their problem is.
Yeah,
that's why people they are not more you're right sympathetic there. With you. You're and right I'm not debating your moral position. I'm just saying they have a structural problem in not understanding international communications.
Once again, the very ambivalent nature of censorship came into play. In 2009, there was a lot of debate over. There were some people who said it was right for China to try to play down ethnic tensions and try to prevent pogroms against Uyghurs by preventing people from sending text messages, or they deemed would inspire vendettas by Han Chinese against their Uyghur neighbors. They did the same thing this time. For the first 12 hours, at least, after they prevented any mention of the word Uyghur, of Xinjiang, no geographic attribution, they deleted. They had plenty of pictures of the victims, but no photos or video of the perpetrators. Nothing that would signal that this was work done by Uyghurs. And my understanding of it was that was deliberately undertaken to try to prevent, you know, kind of retributive acts. What do you think? Do you think that there was no opinions? Okay.
I don't know.
Let's just leave that one hanging there, and I'll and move on to recommendations. Orville, thanks so much for coming in. Do you have something to recommend that you could share with us?
Well, there are two books that one has just come out, which I thought was quite interesting. Emily Parker's book, Now We Know Who Our Comrades Are, which is about the internet in Cuba, Russia, and China, and sort of netizen culture in each place. I found that a nice book. And then I had occasion to read an advance copy of Evan Osnos's new book.
Oh, you lucky son of a bitch.
Yeah, which is not out
yet.
Yeah, it's very nice. Wow, okay. I liked it. I think it's going to, you know, we all have this dilemma of people constantly asking us for a book list.
Right.
You know, what should I read when I go to China? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I always draw just a colossal blank. I never can remember what to recommend. But
Wealth
I think,
and Power is great. Yeah,
that would be, shall I say, a little self-serving.
I've got my
list. But I think Evan's book is a kind of a nice general evocation of things that one could recommend for, you know, okay, this is like eating some kind of a meal in a pouch, you know. It's you get everything, all of the major food groups in it.
he discovered, I mean, he found, I think, the great organizing concept and ambition. What better word could you've organized a book about late 20th, early 21st century China around? That's wonderful.
Yeah. But of course, ambition is such a, it is so present, but of course, then one wants to know, where did it come from? You know, because it wasn't so long ago.
It comes from the search for wealth and power.
Well, I think it does in some ways, but, you know, it wasn't so long ago that China was an utter basket case, completely bereft of any ambition, at least collective ambition, that manifested itself in any effective way.
Jeremy,
so this is quite a stunning turnaround.
Back then, you and me were drinking a lot of beer on Sanlitun.
Yeah. That's
well,
right.
I'm going back a little before.
You don't have to go that far back, though.
No. I mean, in the mid-90s, things were still pretty slow.
Yeah.
That's great. I can't wait to read that. And that's probably the one that I'm looking forward to most. David, what do you have for us?
I'd like to recommend a book by the entire oeuvre of a scholar named Anne-Marie Brady, who's Australian, and she's got a great book called Marketing Dictatorship, Propaganda and Thought Work in Contemporary China. And do you know her or of her?
I do know her work. I haven't read this book. Yeah. Is it out yet?
It's out. It's been out for a while, as someone who has done some work in state media, CCTV, she's a very careful scholar, and it's very geeky. It's not a popular book, and it's not a popularizing book. But it's very thorough about the mechanism of state media, broadcast media, and publication media. And if you want to really understand the nuts and bolts of the hierarchy of how the censorship apparatus works, this is the book. It's very, very good. It's very solid. And all of her, she's very prolific. She has many articles about media and control, and they're all. They're not fun reads. They're not like, you know, they're scholarship in it, but they're very valuable, I think, and people need to spend more attention to them, I think.
Jeremy?
Well, I always tell our guests, much to your chagrin, that they can recommend a tweet if they like. And I will recommend a tweet, but also another thing.
It's like a full night's work to absorb this offering.
Yeah, right. Which Richard McGregor, the former FT bureau chief in Beijing, I think watching Putin's press conference, which is going on around now, saying about the U.S.
Have you been on Twitter this whole time?
No, I just happened to look at it right now. Americans, Putin said, they sit there across the pond, and sometimes I think they feel like they're in a lab and performing experiments on rats. Anyway, I think that's quite a good way of looking at Chinese and Russian view.
concur with the metaphor of rats in Russia.
But my serious recommendation is a website called East by Southeast, which is a blog.
My God, you just took my recommendation.
I did.
Cool.
Okay. Well, it's a blog that I've been aware of for some time, but made myself reacquainted with recently because it's. I think most of the writers are based in Kunming, and they cover Yunnan and Southeast Asia. And today or yesterday, they published your Kaiser's Facebook post about some of the issues we've been discussing about the use of the word terrorist, etc., and lots of other stuff about Kunming and Yunnan and Southeast Asia and the interaction.
Well, their time has certainly come.
Indeed.
Yeah. Brian Eiler, who works at IES, was a colleague of Jeremiah Jenny. He's the guy in charge of that. He's a terrific guy, by the way. So you've taken my recommendation. I've got another one, Hattie, though, that's related to our main topic today. That's a book called The Chinese Enlightenment by Vera Schwartz.
Oh,
yeah, it's a great book.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, so
it's really good intellectual history.
Yeah, it's first-rate intellectual history. It's about the May 4th New Culture Movement and really goes in considerable depth. The companion volume, I would say, is Zhou Zedong's The May 4th Movement. So these two books, if you read them next to each other, you'll know all that you need to know about the most pivotal, important piece of China's intellectual history, the touchstone. Everything that's happened since is sort of in reference to that. You can't understand things like, you know, He Shang River Elegy or, you know, everything that happened in 89 without an understanding of the May 4th movement and the New Culture movement.
True.
So Vera Schwartz and the Chinese Enlightenment. Well, thanks. Thanks again, guys. David, thanks. Orville, great to have you. I mean, next time you're back in town, you're welcome.
Thank you, Orville.
And Jeremy, great man. We've got, like I said, a terrific bunch of shows lined up. Next week, I think we have Mark O'Neill coming out to talk about the Chinese Labor Corps in the First War. And that's going to be fascinating.
First World War.
The First War, yeah, the First World War, of course.
We just call it the First War.
The Great War.
The Great War.
The war to end all wars. And I'm going to be talking to Pankaj Mishra. Jeremy is going to be talking to Adam Minter. I'm going to be talking to Jonathan Fenby. All of this stuff is going to go up online on Seneca. So stay tuned. And we'll see you next week. Take care.